All Things Considered began broadcasting 30 years ago this week. To mark that anniversary, we're looking at other things which began 30 years ago. Today, the war on cancer. Americans were fighting an undeclared war in Vietnam in May of 1971 when President Richard Nixon declared war on cancer. For a president enmeshed in an unpopular war, attacking cancer was something most Americans could support.
One out of every four Americans may contract cancer during his life, unless we make progress in finding a cure for cancer. And as far as the time when it is found, it will not fail because of lack of money. To the extent money is needed, it will be provided.
Over the 30 years, there have been victories and defeats. We've reported that during the first 30 years of All Things Considered. Over the next half hour, we're going to meet some of the doctors who've been involved in cancer research and treatment since the beginning.
When patients come in.
In 1971, Dr. Anna Meadows was still in training for a lifetime of work with children who have cancer. She's seen what is probably the greatest victory, a permanent cure for the most common kind of childhood leukemia, acute lymphocytic leukemia. Walking with Dr. Meadows through the Cancer Center at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, we see lots of sick children and anxious parents, but there is hope now. Most of them will get well. In 1971, most of the children died.
What we said to families then was, if untreated, this is a fatal disease. We know how to make it go away for some time, but our hope is to make it go away forever. We had some hope that almost all children would achieve a remission. What we weren't sure about was how long that would last.
There was a very high rate of remission at first with the treatments that they had then.
Joanne Hanna's four-year-old son David first came to Children's in 1976. Anna Meadows was his doctor. Joanne told us that after feeling sickly for about a month, David's legs began to ache and she began to fear leukemia. He was diagnosed at Children's. Treatment was successful at first.
It was maybe 7-9 months that he was in remission. And, you know, you're just praying that every time there's a blood count done that things will stay the same. And we were in the doctor's office, I think it was about April, and he had a count done, and he had gone out of remission, which meant that, you know, they needed to do some more treatment. So then I knew that there was very little chance that he would ultimately recover.
Dr. Meadows talked about trying to be as truthful with families as she could be, and talking about the disease and the course of the disease and the possibility of death. Did she talk about all of that with you? Did you talk about it with him?
You know, we never talked about him dying. I'm not sure I could have done that, but I do think that he knew in the last couple months that he was dying. He said things to me like, will you remember me in 20 years? And I said I would. And I was fairly sure then that he knew, but he had such a fighting attitude that I wanted to be as supportive of him as I could.
The last round of chemotherapy had no effect, and the family decided not to continue. David Hanna died at home 24 years ago this past April. Leukemia was just really a terrifying diagnosis for a long period of time, wasn't it?
It was about as bad a word as cancer. And I remember in my very early training, we had one child who went longer than 4 years, and that was something amazing. But once we started to use multiple drugs, once we started to protect the central nervous system, the brain, by using radiation at first and then chemotherapy into the spine, we were pretty sure we were going to be on the right track.
Where is Grace? Do you know where she is?
Dr. Meadows introduced us to a patient who is going through a difficult and uncomfortable round of treatment now. Grace McDevitt is 9 years old, a small, sturdy girl who wears glasses and a baseball cap.
I was in the hospital
Hey, you're in my seat, honey.
Every Saturday. Last time I was on methotrexate.
My hand's cold?
No.
So, Grace, tell me about your hair, which you don't seem to have any of.
Well, the medicine makes it fall out. And also, I have about a gazillion hats at home. And it's growing back, and it's nice and fuzzy. And Daddy thinks it's gonna grow back brown because my fuzzies are darker.
Almost all children like Grace are treated at major cancer research centers. The kids are in research protocols, clinical trials. Early on, researchers realized chemotherapy worked well for children. It was a major advance when they found a way around using radiation. Radiation kills cancer cells, but it causes problems for children. Radiation to the brain can cause a child's IQ to go down, even cause brain tumors. Doctors concentrated on improving and refining combinations of drugs and the regimen for giving them, and more children got well. Grace's parents, Tink and Ralph McDevitt, understand that her chances of recovery are good, but one thing the war on cancer has not changed. The diagnosis of leukemia is still a terrifying thing.
They went through every single drug that they would give her and listed all the side effects for every single drug. And by the time we got to the end, you thought, there's no way you're giving these drugs to my child. It's just, you've got to be out of your mind.
Every treatment is an experiment. And to think that they're going to experiment on your child isn't very comforting.
The way that it was explained to us, all children with leukemia, and we're not allowed to use that word in our house, the word is it. All children with it who are treated in a major children's cancer institution are treated with a standardized protocol now because of the 30 years of research that they've done. The standard protocol is proven to be effective for a certain percentage of people. And they don't quote statistics to you because, you know, if they have a 50% cure rate or a 70% cure rate or a 98% cure rate, they don't use those numbers because you only have one child and you're not going to have a child that's 98% alive and 2% dead. You're either going to have a child that's alive or dead.
Grace McDevitt has named her drug combination Lemonade and Hawaiian Punch. In the outpatient room at the cancer center, she prepares for a long bout of intravenous chemotherapy in a room filled with kids hooked up to bottles of medicine, watching cartoons on their own TV sets from their own recliners.
Hi, pick a seat.
Where are you
going to
sit?
This is the most squishiest chair.
So today you'll spend the whole day here then? Is that how it's going to work, Grace?
Yeah.
And then what will the rest of the week be like?
I usually miss the day after I go to clinic and school because the medicine makes me feel really crummy. And when they give me blood and platelets, I feel better, but otherwise they usually make me feel worse.
In 1971, most children with leukemia could go into remission with treatment, but 3/4 of them relapsed, and all of those died. 30 years later, almost all of them go into remission, and at least 3/4 stay there. And about 1/3 of the kids who do relapse can still be cured. In 2001, the odds are with Grace McDevitt. Her doctor, Anna Meadows, now talks about a cure for acute lymphocytic leukemia.
By 1990, we were able to say, if the disease doesn't come back by 4 years after treatment's discontinued, it's unlikely that it will ever come back, and that your child will be cured.
The war on cancer financed an elite squad of doctors and researchers. The National Institutes of Health near Washington served as a clearinghouse for research grants, the place where young scientists and doctors trained to beat cancer. 10 years earlier, President Kennedy had challenged another group of American scientists to send a man to the moon. But in 1971, the war on cancer looked much tougher to Dr. George Canellos. He was then 36, already doing research on breast cancer.
It's not like going to the moon. See, that was the analogy. The moon was easy. We knew exactly where it was. You know, mathematical formulas in physics could tell you how to get to the moon in some ways. But in 1971, we didn't know what orbit we were in. I mean, in terms of the cancer cell, really.
Canellos and his team developed breakthrough combination drug treatments for breast cancer. He's now at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Dr. Harold Varmus, who is now head of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, was another NIH pioneer.
Well, we all view this as a golden time in medical research training focused at the NIH. There were many of us who had been through medical school, were beginning to discover an interest in research, who came together at the NIH and then created a diaspora. Most of us did not stay at the NIH. Most of us went to places around the country where we built very strong research-oriented medical schools.
Varmus, over a period of decades, helped to advance knowledge of molecular biology. That basic science had to be done before researchers could really understand cancer. In 1971, most Americans believed that cancer was one disease, and you got it in the kidney or the breast or the brain. It was years before the many forms of cancer were understood. Dr. Richard Klausner is now the director of the National Cancer Institute at NIH. He says the most profound discovery of the past 30 years was how cancer begins.
Cancer is always a genetic disease, not an inherited type of genetic disease. And this is very confusing to people, because when we think of genes, we think of what we get from our parents. Cancer is the type of genetic disease where the genetic changes happen in our cells in our own lifetime. But the fact that we know that all cancers are the result of the accumulation of a limited number of genetic changes in one of the trillions of cells in our body has provided a truly coherent picture of cancer, and then allows us to map out a type of roadmap of discovery that we now need to take.
A roadmap to new ways to fight cancer, which include common sense prevention as well as entirely new approaches to treatment. Dr. Harold Varmus told us that understanding cancer at the cellular level has given scientists a very practical understanding of the causes.
30 years ago, there was a lot of tension between people who believed in the genetic origins of cancer and the environmental origins of cancer. It's indeed the case that cancer is fundamentally a disease of genes, but it's the exposure to environmental agents, including diet and cigarette smoking and hepatitis B virus and sunlight, combined with the natural error rate that occurs when our cells go through many, many cell divisions and copy 3 billion sets of nucleotides. They make mistakes just like a typist does. So one of the things that we've learned over the last 30 years is that these two points of view are reconcilable.
The fight against cancer proceeded on all fronts at once. So far, prevention has probably saved the most lives, notably when many Americans stopped smoking. Improved treatment, new tests, and early diagnosis have increased the chances of recovery. Some cancers and most advanced cancers are still fatal. But things are better. In 1971, death from cancer was relentlessly rising. In 1990, death rates started to go down. And now cancer treatment has reached a turning point. After many years of killing cancer cells with chemotherapy derived from mustard gas, scientists see another way. Understanding the causes of cancer at the cellular level may make it possible to switch cancer cells off or interrupt some process cancer cells need to grow. Dr. George Canellos.
We're at the cusp of a big change, and I think it is the time to cash in on the fruits of the last 30 years' basic science research. We now know a whole lot about pathways that cells use to control their lives. And all of these pathways, I think, as they are defined, will then allow for the development of molecules that will be tailor-made for the particular problem and will, I think, work in a very specific way. And the first drug that's going to come about very soon is the so-called ST-571, which is a very specific, non-toxic, orally given agent that specifically kills or inhibits a pathway unique to one form of leukemia.
The development of biological drugs that can be taken indefinitely with no side effects may redefine victory in the war on cancer. It may be possible, in the next decade or so of this battle, to stall cancer. People might live with cancer that could not spread, small contained cancers, which would never become dangerous. Dr. Judah Folkman is a legendary pediatric surgeon. Research was a sideline for the first part of his career. A man much acclaimed for groundbreaking research on new ways to treat cancer. He now says most of his patients are mice.
So we got liver, brain, breast, colon. They look wonderful. They're healthy.
Dr. Judah Folkman has done most of his research here at Children's Hospital in Boston. But the work began when he was in the Army. He noticed that cancer cells planted on tissue being kept alive in the laboratory would survive, but not grow into tumors. If the cancer cells were transplanted into a living animal, they did grow. He theorized that the difference was blood. To grow into tumors, the cells needed to, as Dr. Folkman says, recruit a blood supply. He called that creation of new blood vessels angiogenesis. That observation and that theory started Judah Folkman down a road he's been traveling for 40 years.
It took about 10, 15 years to actually design the experiments to prove that tumors do, in fact, recruit new blood vessels. Then, after people began to believe that they did recruit new blood vessels, they said that's a side effect, like pus in a wound. So then we had to show that they really needed it. That took more than a decade. And then the question was, what molecules turn on the blood vessels? And everybody said there aren't any. And by 1989, I would say that most scientists working in the field, to them it was very clear that angiogenesis was a powerful regulator of tumor growth. But it took a long time to get all the pieces in order.
It took even longer and a number of dead ends to reach the big breakthrough, isolating molecules that would interfere with a tumor's blood supply, angiogenesis inhibitors. Now, Folkman wants to find the switch that turns the tumor on, that makes it recruit a blood supply.
No one knows how to turn off angiogenesis in a tumor. What we know is how to stop its effects downstream. So after the tumor has switched on and produces every day angiogenic factors, it never turns off until you take it out or the patient dies. However, if one knew how to turn the switch off, then that might be really a whole next generation. Now, it's quite far out. It's very risky for a career, but it's a very important goal in the lab right now.
Folkman's original research was very nearly career-ending. His theories were considered out there. Now, he has the 10th floor of a wing of Children's Hospital, and there are dozens of postdoctoral researchers in his lab working on a long list of theories and possibilities, with Judah Folkman pushing and pulling and cheerleading.
That's wonderful. This is perfect.
I mean, I can't understand why.
If you can't, do you mind if I do the experiment?
Every Friday, there's a meeting when a few researchers present what they've been doing, and the rest of the crew critiques, with Folkman presiding. On this particular day, Lynn Latke, speaking for her group, presented an example of a mouse tumor with an advanced blood supply.
Okay, so here's the first slide. And what we see here is a quite large liposarcoma. And what we found, much to our surprise, was that we have an artery and a vein feeding this whole tumor.
Let's go around. Tell me, what does this mean?
Latke's presentation set Folkman off on a flight of possibility. If her group could find out how such large vessels were recruited, all kinds of things might flow from that.
This will be known as the Latke mouse. Everybody in the world would be studying this for 15 years. It's incredible. I've never seen this model.
Judah Folkman is a curious combination, a man with a mind that leaps around, coupled to a will to spend years doing the finicky, incremental research that eventually gets him where he believes he can go.
We always said there's a fine line between persistence and obstinacy in research, and you never know when you've crossed that.
And as for where he thinks the war on cancer might go next, Dr. Folkman says he imagines it could follow a path similar to bacterial infection.
1,000 years back, there was not a drug for any infection. The only way to treat infection was wait till it was pus and drain it surgically. And if you couldn't drain it, you would die. Somewhere in the mid-1930s, arsenic for syphilis. Then in the late 30s comes sulfa. You could treat pneumonia. Then 41, penicillin. And nowadays, most of our young doctors won't even know where the infection is. They get a blood test, you've got an infection, they treat it, the blood test is normal. On the other hand, the same doctor, if you have a diagnosis of cancer this morning, the second question is where? Prostate, pancreas, breast, esophagus? If you don't know where, you can't treat it, right? Now comes anti-angiogenic therapy that's not harsh, or other kinds of vaccine therapy. So this may be the general direction. No one can tell anybody what the timing is. And no one in the field, I think, talks about cancer cure any more than we talk about curing heart disease. You talk about converting it to a manageable chronic problem that doesn't cause dis-ease. And that might be a goal.
For Dr. Judah Folkman and the other veteran researchers we met, the war on cancer is not over. They share the belief that cancer treatment is about to change drastically, that biological, non-toxic treatments are coming soon. But of course, the reason the war began is the principal reason scientists expect it to continue. Despite 30 years of progress, cancer is still a killer.